You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Before we begin this week's episode of Stick Together, I want to acknowledge the Westgate Bridge disaster that occurred in Melbourne on this week in 1970. It's a reminder that still today, some workers go to work and don't return home to their family and friends. On that day, 35 construction workers were killed and 18 injured, and it's an impact that is greatly felt still amongst workers in that industry. So remember those workers today on this week that marks 55 years since that disaster, and reminds us that unions and workers' safety are as important then as they are today. You're listening to Stick Together, the only national radio show focusing on union news, workers' issues, and social justice. This show is brought to you by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We thank them for their ongoing support. Welcome to this week's union news. UWU Queensland, Repco. Workers at Repco's largest distribution centre in Queensland went on strike for 24 hours. The strike follows a breakdown in negotiations and a lowball offer from Repco. This is the first ever strike by Repco workers in Queensland. UWU members are fighting for a fair deal. They know workers at Supercheap Auto's distribution centre earn $5 to $6 more than workers at premium supplier Repco. The Services Union Southern Downs Regional Council. Members of the Services Union at Southern Downs Regional Council will participate in a two-hour stop work action on Thursday. Workers don't accept the council's current offer of a 4% wage increase with no back pay, proposals that strip away any conditions. New South Wales NMA, Public Sector Nurses and Midwives, have voted to accept the New South Wales State Government's interim offer. Public Sector Nurses and Midwives will receive a 3% wage increase backdated to July 1. In addition to the wage increase, the interim offer will also lift night shift penalty rates from 15 to 20%, guarantee two consecutive days off, require consultation before roster changes, and ensure no night duty the night before you take annual leave. The New South Wales NMA will still pursue a 35% pay increase in its special case to the New South Wales Industrial Relations Commission, which is due to commence later this month. The CPSU-PSU group, the Democracy for CPSU faction within the CPSU-PSU group, which covers federal public servants as well as those in ACT and NT, has written an open letter to the Progressive Caucus, which currently holds the leadership of the union. The letter outlines what actions the incumbents would need to take in order for Democracy for CPSU to feel they do not need to contest the upcoming elections. These include committing to organising members to take industrial action, setting density targets and reporting on them, the establishment of a strike fund, committing to undertake protected action ballots following the expiry of agreements, reforming the democratic culture of the union, and issuing a statement on the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Democracy for CPSU contested the last CPSU-PSU group elections in 2023. Since then, two CPSU state branches, Victoria and SA, have had contested elections resulting in incumbents losing their control of the branches. The elections will be held in late 2026. And that's it for union news this week.
This show was produced on the lands of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respect to their elders, both past and present, and recognise the ongoing impact of colonisation right across the continent.
Bangladeshi garment workers have been in the news for more than a decade now, with serious concerns about their working conditions, with some really famous incidents occurring, such as the fires that occurred in a number of factories, as well as protests across Bangladesh, and with solidarity actions happening across the country and indeed the world. Going to hear a couple of clips now to give a bit more context about Australia's role in the fast fashion and the garment workers in Bangladesh, and talking about an action that happened a little while ago in Melbourne with the RAFU, Union Aid Abroad, AAWL, and others who joined in solidarity with those workers.
An Aussie fast fashion giant reportedly owes more than $30 million to these factories here in Bangladesh. Mosaic Brands, which owns labels like Rivers, Rockmans, Miller's, Noni B, has entered voluntary administration.
And the problem started from this year, beginning of this year. They suddenly stopped all of our payment, almost $2 million that time. Now it's more than this. Here I have more than 2,500 workers.
Tens of thousands of Bangladeshi garment workers who make Mosaic's clothes are worried that means they could lose their jobs.
Everyone will be affected by this non-payment. Thousands of workers are working here. How can the owner manage this loss? At best, he can maintain several workers. What about the others?
Mosaic's administrators are due to meet with creditors in the coming weeks. Mosaic's receivers say there may be an opportunity for suppliers to reset trading terms post-receivership. An Aussie fast fashion giant reported...
Thanks to the ABC and RAFU for that audio. Now let's hear interview.
You're listening to Stick Together, union news and workers' stories on 3CR Community Radio and across the Community Radio Network. I'm James, and today we're taking a closer look at the clothes we wear and the exploitation that's woven into the many garments. A new report from Oxfam Australia, Unravelling Exploitation, reveals shocking conditions in the global garment industry, including child labour, wage theft and modern slavery, with many Australian fashion brands implicated through their sourcing from Bangladesh. But this isn't just about faraway factories, it's about the global structures and local responsibilities that enable exploitation. And it's about how workers, unions and campaigners are pushing back. Joining us today is Nina Crawley, campaign and advocacy lead at Oxfam Australia. Nina's been deeply involved in the What She Makes campaign and co-authored this new report. Nina, thanks so much for joining us on Stick Together today.
Thanks so much for having me, James.
I guess as we start, maybe can you tell us about how you went about kind of sourcing the information that kind of brought about this report? Because it's a pretty big document and, you know, really substantial work that's gone into it. And I imagine that, it can be difficult to kind of get to some of the people that you're wanting to speak to as well. How did you kind of initially go about doing that?
Yeah, thank you. That's a really good question. So the sort of impetus to write this report started a couple of years ago. I've actually had a baby in between, left work and come back and then picked the report back up. So look, we engaged a local consultant who often works with international development agencies to, you know, review their programs, and they conducted some quantitative research with about 400 workers in factories, which is where we got some of our information from. And that brought through some really strong evidence around wages and some, you know, really strong evidence around stuff that was easily measurable, like the amount of overtime people were working or, but it really didn't tell the whole story we were wanting to tell. And we felt like there was something missing. And so we reached out to a partner that our colleagues in Oxfam and Bangladesh work with often called Komadiginari, who's a women's rights organisation, but through their work supporting women, they're often supporting workers' rights as well. And they conducted a number of focus groups and sort of more in-depth qualitative data, which I think, you know, the richest and most interesting data came from. As part of that, they also did some interviews with trade union leaders, which was really useful data. And they were able to provide that sort of more of a systematic overview of the industry and some of the greater themes and greater issues that they see. So, I don't think in some ways it was perfect. And I think we learnt a lot through doing this. And we learnt a lot about the power of using, workers' rights organisations or women's rights organisations who are really well connected with the folks on the ground, with the workers. And to be honest, we're actually really excited to dig into this this more and work on those relationships that we've built and sort of continue to explore these topics, because I think we're just starting to scratch the surface and just starting to build those relationships.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, it would be once you sort of unravel a little bit of this, you kind of just want to continue to go deeper and deeper into it. And I guess, you know, one of the, I guess, alarming kind of things that we hear the word slavery and that, you know, should ring alarm bells to people who are reading that. What does that really mean, I guess, in terms of the report findings, and what does that look like for, you know, for women and children who are in, you know, in these factories?
Yeah, I mean, modern slavery itself has like a sort of definition under law, and Australia has a Modern Slavery Act, which speaks to specific practices that constitute modern slavery. And things like forced marriage even fall under that definition. So, you know, that wasn't all, like people paying recruitment fees and issues with recruitment of migrant workers is also a really common form of modern slavery we find. But our report didn't deal with that specifically. Our report was mostly focused on forced labour. So that's when people are coerced into working against their will. Or and also, of course, child labour. So child labour also falls under that broad definition of modern slavery, according to that Modern Slavery Act.
And the report found 95% of surveyed workers aren't earning a living wage. What is that? I mean, I think, you know, we can look at what the wages look like comparatively to, you know, Australian wages. But what does that mean in terms of, you know, what is the report asking for those to change? And I guess, like you said, union groups and workers groups kind of asking for that to look like.
Yeah, absolutely. And I might also just point out, like, if you only take women's wages, that actually jumped to 100%. So there were a few men who were all supervisors who were included in that survey. So, which is, you know, interesting to note. So, I mean, the current in Bangladesh, and to be clear, this isn't a Bangladesh problem. We research in Bangladesh. We have some good connections there, but this is a global issue. In Bangladesh, the current minimum wage for garment workers is around about 12,000 taka. It was only a couple of years ago, the wage negotiations were happening, the minimum wage negotiations with government, and workers and their unions were arguing for that to be increased to 25,000. So, and that would constitute a living wage. So you can see there's a vast difference between what the current minimum wage is and what the living wage is. And we see real life implications for this. And you know, we're talking about people not being able to literally not afford enough food by the end of the month. So it's very strong and obvious implications for those workers. And we see that coming through with the child workers, where all the child workers we interviewed, they started work because of the illness of a parent. So when you don't have enough money for food, when you don't have enough money for medical care, you know, if something unexpected happens, it actually puts your family into crisis. And that's where things like child labour.
And we've seen, you know, like you mentioned, it's not just Bangladesh, and, you know, that there's plenty of other places where this kind of exploitation is happening, but focusing on Bangladesh for the purpose of today. And, you know, we've seen some, you know, pretty horrific working conditions, fires and things like that over the past kind of decade or so. But the report also goes into some of the home conditions where people are, you know, making garments in their home and other kind of makeshift areas. What are the kind of risks with that? And, you know, what kind of was uncovered with those, you know, that kind of shadow industry?
Yeah, absolutely. So I suppose, we dealt with home-based workers and then also workers who were working in subcontracting factories, which, you know, could be in somebody's home, but might be, you know, just in some sort of subpar factory building. For home-based workers specifically, so folks actually working out of their own home, the biggest issues for them is that their pay is absolutely the worst. So they face enormous financial pressures. From an organised labour perspective, it's obviously very difficult to organise home workers. So of all groups of workers, they're the most isolated, the least likely to be able to connect with others to assert their rights. And so that, I think, throws up a really interesting question for the industry as a whole. A lot of these workers reported to us that they left factories for important reasons. They were being sexually harassed in factories, perhaps, and they liked to escape that. They had young children, perhaps, and they needed to be able to work and supervise their child at the same time. So in some ways, home-based work was working for women, just as it does here. But in other ways, they were lacking protection. So it's a real question to the industry. How can we first account for these home-based workers who often don't appear on any books? And then secondly, how can we provide support for them so that they're not isolated and they're able to organise?
It sounds like some of the same kind of reasons, you know, where you look at working from home and, you know, going right back to, I guess, casualisation in, you know, countries like Australia are the reasons that workers are kind of wanting that flexibility with their work. But, you know, as is often the case, that the employer is, you know, exploiting that avenue when it comes out as well. When you spoke before about the kind of Modern Slavery Act, what do you kind of think is missing from that current legal framework that would improve things there?
Yeah, look, there's much missing from our current legal framework. So the Modern Slavery Act is essentially just an exercise in transparency. All it asks companies to do is just to report the risks that are present in their supply chains. And we know that they're not even doing that adequately. So, you could sort of pick up any given modern slavery report from a company. And if you knew a little bit more about the industry, you could read it and note, oh, hang on, you're manufacturing in a particular part of China and you haven't mentioned that. Or, you haven't mentioned low wages or the fact that home-based workers could be present in your supply chain. So we know that it's not even working to do what it says it does. And it's also an act that has no penalties and no enforcement. So it's currently under review. Government's looking at introducing them, but even then it wouldn't go far enough. So it's looking quite narrowly at modern slavery when we know that there's a whole raft of human rights that are impacting workers. So, for example, these extreme poverty wages that are putting workers in these vulnerable positions where they're more open to exploitation, more open to issues like child labour, that's not covered. So, for example, if you're an Indigenous person and an organisation comes in and uses your land and doesn't provide you compensation, that's not covered. So we actually really need broader human rights protections and requirements for Australian companies to, you know, have a duty to protect people's human rights from being violated as part of them doing business.
You're listening to Stick Together with your host, James, and we're listening to an interview with Nina from Oxfam. And I guess, you know, thinking about in Australia, you know, I'm sure that, I don't know if you want to name some of the companies in Australia that are involved in, in this process. And I guess thinking about what can we do in Australia, both in terms of, individual kind of consumerism about, you know, the products that we're buying and, you know, our kind of role within fast fashion. And then also looking at, how can we put pressure on unions and the government to kind of enact some change around this?
Thank you. And look, I straight up, I'd have to say I'm not in a position to name companies based on our recent research. It's a purposely opaque situation where we can't see which brands are using these subcontracting factories where these worst abuses are happening. And that's part of the problem, isn't it? We need, it's difficult for INGOs and civil society to do all that heavy lifting, to do all that investigation. We actually need to push that onus back onto companies that are making billions of dollars. So for consumers, I would say, of course, consider, what you need to buy and buy a second hand. But at the end of the day, you're going to have to buy some jocks for your five-year-old and you're probably going to go to a big retailer to do that. And I think it's important for us to remember this isn't, it's not the fault of other workers that this is happening. These are big systems and we should rely on our government to make sure it doesn't happen. So we've got a petition at the moment asking the federal government to put import bans on goods made with forced labour and to introduce responsible business laws that require brands to look after human rights in their supply chains. So certainly they can take that action and they can speak to their local MPs about these issues. And lastly, I would say, if you've still got some energy, certainly contact, some of your favourite brands or brands that you might be using and ask them, what provisions do you have in place for modern slavery? Because the more they can see pressure from consumers that care about these issues, the more likely they are to shift.
And I think what has been the response from unions, both in Australia and you spoke about some of the labour organisations in Bangladesh as well. Is there solidarity between, the trade union kind of organisations in both countries? And yeah, what's your kind of research uncovered about that?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's certainly solidarity. So we've actually just wrapped up 2 days of a sort of major UN Human Rights in Business conference that was held in Melbourne at RMIT, which was really great. And there's very strong representation there from Australia's trade unions, and they're supportive of that event. So I think amongst the Australian movement, there is solidarity in pushing for stronger regulatory frameworks from government. And that is also a call that many union leaders overseas have. So, for example, we feature Kalpona Akhtar, who is a sort of, you know, quite a well-known Bangladeshi union leader who has been calling for mandatory human rights due diligence. I think it's really important, though, for that to not be overstated, and to understand this in the context from which we're in, where we've still got this immense power as a sort of, you know, as Australia in this, or, you know, part of kind of the West in this relationship, and to understand that the circumstances that trade unions are operating under in many of these high-risk for modern slavery countries are extremely difficult. It's very hard to register unions. In China, only one trade union exists, which is run by the government. Bangladeshi union leaders were being killed fighting for their minimum wages. So there are diverse unions and there are diverse needs. And I think that there are some great challenges in working together when there's an inherent power imbalance, I suppose, within the relationship of, you know, sort of supplier and buyer, whether it's financial, whether it's between our sort of civil society movements. Sorry, that wasn't a simple answer.
No,
but I think
not a simple
it's important
issue, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, I guess, you know, we think about some of the things around, you know, buying ethically, and, you know, we spoke about, you know, we don't need to buy $3 t-shirts every week and things like that. But, you know, I guess people put back an issue around, you know, working class people in Australia obviously can struggle as well to, you know, people don't want to spend $60 on a t-shirt or things like that as well. There's kind of a real mindset around, instead of buying kind of like quality things, and we buy things around fast fashion. But yeah, I guess it's, there's a lead which Oxfam is kind of a part of, I guess, in terms of trying to change people's mindset around that. And I feel like that's a big issue that is, it's not, not to just put it all on individualism, but it's a kind of thing that can help people to shift, to kind of change the mind of the government to kind of do something about it as well.
Absolutely. Thank you for bringing that up. It's working class people. It's also people in different bodies. You know, like many ethical clothing fashion labels don't have size inclusive sizing. So, like, you know, I'm not going to put it on any one individual for, you know, shopping at a big store. And then at the end of the day too, there's a lot of greenwashing out there. And it might be that you think you're doing the right thing purchasing off a particular brand, but actually they've still got some really dodgy labor practices sitting below that. So I think I think it really does come back to our government. And we know, like, we've done polls, like, you know, close to 80% of Australians expect the government to do more to prevent these kinds of abuses in our supply chains. And I think that's a really reasonable expectation. And it's actually something that's happening globally as well. You know, we're at risk as Australia at the moment. If we don't introduce import bans, they will probably be in place. They are in place in the US. They will be in place in the future in the UK and the EU. Where's the next market people are going to sell these cheap goods made through forced labour to? Australia and New Zealand. So unless we catch up, we're actually going to become a dumping ground for even more of these types of products.
Well, yeah, I think it's a really fascinating kind of the whole report. It's really well kind of put together and things as well. It's pretty easy to read if people are interested. I think they can, yeah, have a read of that and think about the kind of things that they can do to make a difference in kind of advocating for change around that as well. Nina, I don't know, did you have anything else you wanted to kind of say to listeners around, things that they can do to kind of get involved or to find out more about the campaign?
Yeah, I guess, you know, hop over to Oxfam's webpage. The petition is there. Please go ahead and sign it. You know, we're not the only organisation working on this at the moment. We collaborated with Human Rights Law Centre. They've got a really interesting case at the moment against Kmart, which, you know, check out their website, follow along with that. And thank you so much for having me, James.
Thanks for being on the show. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Okay, have a great day.
You too. See ya. Thanks for joining us on this week's episode. I've been your host, James. If you want to get in touch with the producers of the show, you can contact us at sticktogether3cr@gmail.com. If you want to listen back to any other episodes, you can jump on the 3CR website, 3CR Stick Together, and you can catch any episodes on your favorite podcast app. And remember, wherever you are, whatever you do, there's a union for you. Until next time, stick together.
And to finish the show, we're going to hear from Della Dapp with their song Dirty Jazz. Until next time, stick together.
Nice and neat is not the way we roll. Free yourself, I bet you can. If you wanna join the club, come in, you are my man. You don't need to know the rules. We don't even know them, hey. We're not at school. Take a seat, enjoy the show. Welcome to our basement jam.
Listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.